Thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara-Byrne. Tonight, longtime sportscaster and now author Lisa Bowes joins me to talk about the inspiration and the message behind her Lucy Tries Sports children's book series and how her education, career, and personal life all played a role in bringing it together. And we look at the rising popularity of women's sports and how much that will help with the message she's hoping to deliver. Swifties worldwide are hunkered down today with a new double album from Taylor Swift, the music phenom, called The Tortured Poets Department. It's already set a new record for streams in a single day with 200 million and counting on Spotify. But you'll understand Swift's influence extends far beyond music, even into university classrooms. So let's call it Swift Justice. What can Taylor's career teach us about the law? We head to Queen's University in Kingston to find out. This weekend marks 25 years since the shooting at Columbine High School in a suburb of Denver, Colorado. 12 students and a teacher were shot to death when two classmates stormed the school and opened fire in April of 1999. It was hoped that that event would so shock people that it would never happen again, but history, of course, tells us a very different story. We meet a Colorado woman still working hard to prevent those very same acts of violence from happening again. But first, the jury selection in the Donald Trump hush money trial in Manhattan is complete, much faster than many had expected. So opening arguments for the first criminal trial of a former president in history will indeed be heard on Monday. We take you inside the courtroom with a reporter who was there to witness firsthand all the events of the past week. We will begin, though, in a place that I have been, Manhattan. And a statement from the judge today in the Donald Trump hush money trial. We are going to have opening statements on Monday morning. The trial is starting. Those words from Juan Merchan. Big words, because we didn't quite think we would get here this fast. A jury of 12 people and six alternates have been seated. And again, that happened quite a bit faster than legal experts had been expecting as recently as the beginning of the week. So it means the former U.S. president's trial on charges of falsifying business records to funnel money to an adult actress before the 2016 election is set to move forward on Monday, the first time a president or former president has ever faced a criminal trial, and this for the Republican nominee in the November election.
Opening statements will be Monday in former President Trump's criminal hush money trial. Judge Juan Merchan admonished the defense to stop filing letters, quote, targeting individual decisions one by one by one. The judge said he's entertained their motions and arguments, and there's nothing else to clarify or argue. Earlier Friday, the 12 jurors and six alternates were seated. Brian Clark, ABC News.
So it will begin. It will begin, it seems, on Monday. The case, of course, centers around $130,000 Trump's lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, paid to porn actress Stormy Daniels. Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records, but denies any wrongdoing. And it has been quite the week with the sort of drama one might expect in such a high-profile affair. It brought a steady stream of potential jurors who told the court and the former president, who was sitting right there, that they couldn't be impartial. Some potential jurors even wept at the thought of being seated on the jury, according to the Washington Post. But they did find 12 jurors and six alternates, including a sales professional, a software engineer, an English teacher, multiple lawyers, apparently. It is Manhattan, obviously. And this is just the beginning in every which way. Now comes the evidence and the testimony, and witnesses will include, apparently, Trump's former lawyer, as mentioned, Michael Cohen, will be testifying against him. Stormy Daniels herself may even testify. Hope Hicks, Trump's former communications director, is also on the potential witness list. So lots of drama awaits. Now, reporters have been arriving at the Lower Manhattan courtroom before sunrise, before 6 a.m., to make sure they get a seat in the courtroom. And my next guest was among them this morning and in the courtroom today. Alex Woodward is the senior U.S. reporter for the U.K. Independent, and he joins me now. Alex, thank you so much.
Hi, yes, no problem at all. Thank you so much for having me.
What a week to be there in person. I know sometimes we use the word sort of, you know, unprecedented, but this is indeed, as far as history is concerned, the first former U.S. president to stand a criminal trial. And you've been in there all week. What's it been like?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've had jury selection all week, which has been pretty limited to the public and the press. There's a small pool of reporters who are in the actual courtroom, sitting, you know, close to the former president, his attorneys, prosecutors. And then there's an overflow courtroom right next door to that courtroom, where we can see all of the action on screens.
Right. Including Trump, right? I mean, you can actually see him because you're sitting in the courtroom, you'd be behind him. You wouldn't be able to see his reaction to stuff.
This afternoon, for example, I was in the main courtroom and I could kind of peer at his side of his face, back of his head. But in the overflow where we could see him on the screen, we can see his full face. But yeah, the main courtroom too also has the screens, so everyone's able to get a good look of his body language, his behavior, and how he reacts to jurors talking to his face, essentially, and the arguments that prosecutors are presenting.
Yeah, that's been really interesting because obviously, I mean, this time last week, I was speaking with someone who felt like the jury selection might take a really long time. And instead, it seemed to happen quite quickly by prediction standards. And here we are. I mean, we're done Friday and it's done, right? Trial starts Monday.
Yes, we're going to have oral arguments on Monday morning. New York Justice Juan Merchan has been very eager to get this trial moving on time. He's already had to delay it by several weeks. You know, we had juror after juror in front of the court, and all of them essentially promised to be fair and impartial, except for those who were excused. And they were ready to roll. There wasn't a lot of disputes that could be made over a lot of the content of their question and answer sessions. The jury was promising to do as they're instructed and to give Trump a fair shot.
I mean, I've been through jury selection for high profile trials, organized crime trials and so on in the past. And it's interesting to watch because part of it is so mundane. It's just like any other trial. But yet, because of who the defendant is in this one, it becomes such a very big deal. What was it like just to say, I mean, I gather some of the people were answering sort of long-winded, there's a long questionnaire, right? People were kind of talking about the former president to his face, as you pointed out, which can't be an easy thing for anybody.
Yeah, I mean, imagine getting a notice to appear for jury duty in New York, where there's a million things going on, showing up to court, sitting there wondering when your name's going to get called, and then sitting in a courtroom and staring at Donald Trump and handed a 42-question survey where you basically have to give your life story. You got to tell the former president and current, prospective Republican nominee what you do for a living, what your hobbies are, and what you think of him.
And what you think of him? How did that go? Because he's not one to hide his emotions when people talk about him, right?
Yeah, and people weren't necessarily holding back that much either. He even got a few compliments. But yeah, I mean, he was told that he's selfish and self-serving. He was told that his rhetoric is hurtful and that he inspires, racist and misogynistic comments. And, he just had to sit there and eat it, basically. There's nothing he can do about it. However, at one point, he did, I believe this is earlier this week, he reacted, and the judge was very quick to reprimand him and said, basically, if you do that again, you're out of here. I'm going to count that as juror intimidation, and we can't have that in this court.
And apparently, well, at least he was awake, right? I mean, apparently he fell asleep a couple of times earlier in the week, to be fair. Earlier in the week, to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of sleepy in there, I guess. This is not his first rodeo. He's been in a lot of these proceedings. You get the impression that he's pretty bored with it. I mean, it's Donald Trump. He doesn't believe he's done anything wrong, and he thinks he's above, the being in a court of law in this case. But yeah, he closed his eyes quite a bit, leaned back and forth, tried to get comfortable, but for the most part was staring pretty intensely at the jurors while they were talking, or he was, leaning forward, very, very stiff, maybe making casual, comment to his attorney in their ear, but otherwise was just kind of attentive and looking very much like he did not want to be there.
No doubt. So who did they want? I know you've been told by the judge not to talk too much about the jurors, but who did they wind up with? I mean, who are these 12 jurors and six alternates going to be, or at least the 12 jurors? Because this is a very weighty trial, despite the fact the trial itself isn't that complex. I mean, the outcome could be earth-changing in many ways.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, at the end of the day, these are the people who are essentially tasked with potentially delivering a verdict against a former president and current presidential candidate. That's pretty huge, and I can't imagine that's not weighing on any of them.
Yeah.
I know,
Some lawyers in
certainly.
there, right? I mean, they come from all walks of
Yes.
life. I mean, it was
Yeah.
kind of interesting because obviously the area is very democratic, right? So the idea was that it was going to be tough
Sure.
to find that kind of a jury in that part of New York. But they came up with quite a mix of people, right?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, it's Manhattan, so there's a bajillion people here. But of course, you're gonna drum up some lawyers and people who work in finance. I mean, that's
Right.
just gonna be like inevitable. But they ended up with a pretty diverse cross section of the city. You got people from Upper West Side. You got a lot of native New Yorkers. People live in Harlem, Hell's Kitchen. People work in IT. Former school teachers, software engineers, single, married. I believe it came down to five women and seven men on the main jury panel. And the age range seems pretty diverse. Of course, we're not seeing or necessarily just able to describe them per the judge's
For the
order.
order, but still a sort of your standard jury, right? It should be interesting. Alex Woodward is the senior U.S. reporter for the U.K. Independent, where he's been in court all week alongside the former president Donald Trump. Where today they officially picked 12 jurors and six alternates. It's done. We thought it might take a much longer time, and so that means that Donald Trump's criminal trial on this hush money case actually will begin officially on Monday. Well, it's already begun, but the trial will begin on Monday morning with opening arguments. So, Alex, just a reminder, I mean, this is the hush money trial. He's essentially accused of having had his lawyer pay off someone to hide this affair with Stormy Daniels from coming out. And this is the genesis of this case, right?
Yeah, exactly. We use the hush money trial or hush money case as a kind of shorthand for this, but it boils down to 34 counts of falsifying business records to conceal those payments, right, to an adult film star. But it took place ahead of the 2016 presidential election. So we're not just talking about misdemeanors here. Prosecutors are trying to make the case that this is a felony in service of basically lying to voters and creating an election interference case in the process.
Right. And we'll hear, I guess, opening arguments. We're going to figure out exactly what the prosecution is going to lay out as their case and how the defense is going to defend the former president on Monday.
Right. We're anticipating prosecutors detailing that scheme to jurors when we step in on Monday morning.
Difficult case to prove is that is this I mean it's been it's hard to sometimes separate the politics from the legalese here, right? But as a legal case purely, is it your perception so far from who you've spoken to that this will be a difficult case, or is it pretty cut and dried?
I guess it kind of depends where the jury goes with it and how prosecutors really make that argument. They feel like they have a pretty cut and dry, very simple case when you look at the documents, text messages, and emails. They feel like that buttons things up pretty neatly. They don't really need to do too much convincing, but connecting it to a larger scheme of concealing information from voters in service of protecting your election chances. They'll introduce evidence pointing to, kind of a years-long effort of working on that, starting back in 2015, and then with the release of the Access Hollywood tape on, which Trump is heard saying some pretty vulgar things about women. They'll also argue that that really kicked things into gear for them. They didn't want another Access Hollywood-like revelation out in the public because that was already, causing them some serious problems. They were losing endorsements. Republicans were starting to distance themselves from him. So that's going to be the case that they make, and connecting the dots between those two things will be the challenge for prosecutors, but they seem pretty confident that that's what they'll be able to prove to a jury.
Do you have a concept yet of how Trump's defense is going to argue that this isn't so? Other than the bluster, other than the I don't deserve to be here witch hunt stuff?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, they'll likely make the case that or try to argue that this is common, that you can have these kind of catch and kill schemes with the
Right. When
press, and there's nothing
you
illegal
bury a
about it.
bad story, right? Of course.
Exactly. And then, right, trying to separate that from the campaign attempts to distance themselves from embarrassing or compromising stories.
Interesting. You've been there. Just how, what's your impression of the man himself? How's he? I mean, there's always so much fascination with him, which is part of the problem,
Sure,
of
yeah.
course. But what's your take so far on how he's handled this first week of the trial?
Right, yeah, he uses courtrooms now is an extension of his campaign, and this trial is no exception. He uses the hallway to, you know, stage impromptu press conferences, say something that'll get everyone's attention and, you know, draw attention to his outrageous behavior. Meanwhile, he's in court where there's no cameras. There's no way for people to, you know, essentially prove what's going on other than taking the reporter's word for it. And he uses that to his advantage. He can tell his followers what he believes is happening. And that's been no different than, for example, how the civil fraud trial happened here, how the E. Jean Carroll defamation trials happened here. He sulks in court. He's tired. He's exhausted. He doesn't want to be there. And then when he's in the hallway, you know, he's the star of the show. He can say what a witch hunt it is and how corrupt and conflicted everyone is. And you know, that's going to be the campaign line.
Right. And you've had to get up, and just to be fair, reporters, mm-hmm. everybody who wants to be there has had to be there before the break of dawn to get in, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's been a kind of convoluted process for the press. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're all in there and we're all working hard to broadcast as much as we can from our live blogs or Twitter or whatever.
Indeed. Alex, good luck on Monday. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you so much.
It was 25 years ago tomorrow, my how time flies, right? That many of us watched in horror as a deadly shooting at a school took place, Columbine High School, in the Denver suburb of Littleton, Colorado.
The reaction of so many people today was, oh no, not again. Another high school, Columbine High in Littleton, Colorado, this time on the edge of Denver. It has been a horror. The gunman, fellow students who rushed the school and opened fire for reasons we do not know yet, for reasons we may never know.
The incomparable late Peter Jennings there announcing that on ABC News back in 1999. There had been similar acts of violence in schools, including a deadly shooting at an Ottawa high school back in 1975. But this one somehow was a shift from what we'd seen before. Two gunmen, friends, seniors at that school, opened fire on their classmates and their teachers, killing 13 and injuring 21 others. Scenes of students fleeing with their hands up high, the chaos of the moment, coinciding with the ever greater attention of 24-hour news, the internet, and so on, meant that its impact was unlike any school shooting before it. Inside, survivors still remember the systematic way their two heavily armed classmates, having planned the attack for months, methodically went through parts of the school taking lives. Craig Scott survived. His sister and two close friends did not. Here's some of what he told ABC News this week.
And they shot and killed Isaiah. They shot and killed my friend Matt. And they left me under there. I thought I was going to die. I can't tell you how thankful I was to be alive. I was, at the same time, I felt, I didn't know what to call it then. It was survivor's guilt, but I felt bad that I left my friends underneath that table.
Craig Scott there. Both perpetrators would take their own lives. No definitive motive was ever determined. It was thought at the time, hoped, that the Columbine school shooting would become a catalyst, the push to make sure it never happened again. Well, history since tells us a very different story. It was at the time the deadliest mass shooting at a K-12 school in U.S. history, until Sandy Hook Elementary School in December 2012, and then Uvalde in May of 2022. It was the deadliest mass shooting at a U.S. high school until Parkland High School in February 2016. So there have been other tragedies since, sadly. Here's Krista Hanley, also a Columbine school shooting survivor.
Every time there's a shooting, it brings back the trauma. It's heartbreaking to see this happen again and again and again, and sort of having, you know, frankly, I have very little hope that things will change, because things should have changed after Columbine.
Krista Hanley there. Joining me now is Beverly Kingston. She's director of the Center for the Study of Prevention, or the Study and Prevention of Violence at the University of Colorado Boulder, not far from Littleton. Thanks for your time tonight.
Great to be here. Thank you.
It's funny, the events that stand out in your mind when you think back to them. And I remember distinctly where I was, because I was in journalism school. Actually, I think you were just starting a PhD when Columbine happened. I don't know why it's such a marking one, but it is. What about for you? I mean, you're not that far away, actually, from Littleton, are you?
I'm not now, but at that time, I had just been accepted to the PhD program at University of Colorado Boulder in sociology, and I was coming to study at CU Boulder because of the Center for the Study and Prevention of Violence. And so I had just visited, and then Columbine happened. So yeah, I was like, that's where I'm going to be living. How far away is Littleton? And, you know, and I wonder how this is going to affect the work that the center is doing.
Yeah, it was, I try to think back now, because sometimes a quarter century is a long time. Why was it so shocking? Because there had been school shootings before, not many, but there had been school shootings in the past. What was it about Columbine that so kind of shifted the paradigm so drastically? I mean, specifically with what you do, but just generally.
Yeah. I mean, it really, like you said, is something that it seems like no matter who I talk to, they can say they remember where they were, you know, when Columbine happened. I guess it was like a really big wake-up call for the nation, and not only in the U.S., but you can say Columbine in other countries. If I've traveled to other countries and I talk about it, and they know what I'm talking about there as well. And I think it's a part of it was the fact that that's right around the time that we started to have CNN and 24/7 news. And so we were
even the internet, right? Even the internet, sort of the beginnings of
that was just like in the early phases, and we're watching this unfold on TV, like live in real time. We're watching as the law enforcement aren't going into the school. We're watching the chaos, news people, you know, everywhere. I mean, gosh, as you're saying that, I'm just being brought right back, brought to the news and you know, and what that was like. And it was really chaotic at that time. There were no crisis response plans in schools, which are standard practice today. There was no reunification plan for what to do after a mass shooting happens. And so there was no protocols to talk to the media. The media didn't know not to say the names of the shooters. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was so much that just like went, you know.
Yeah. Chaos in real time, right? I mean, that's what it felt like. Just kids running all over the place and the fear. And it was just, and then once the identities of the shooters became known as well, it was sort of the whole thing became so, it was so shocking that two young men would do this to their own, right? I don't think we had really understood the gravity of that, or that it could even happen in the past in the way that it was so systemic. Oftentimes, and here we are on the 25th anniversary, pointing back to the fact that while everyone had hoped at the time that that event was so shocking and so awful that it would never happen again. And of course, it has happened again repeatedly, as you've pointed out. But it was a wake-up call. I'll ask you about the other ones after, but it was a wake-up call. We shouldn't forget that things did change after that day in April of 1999.
Yeah, and it was. I mean, it was like this huge call to action where so many different, at so many different levels. I mean, at the federal level at that time, you know, different departments, organizations were saying, hey, what can we do here? Like the CDC put in place an initiative that's still going today called the Youth Violence Prevention Centers. And there's a big federal initiative called Safe Schools, Healthy Students that came out that isn't here anymore today. The Surgeon General's report on youth violence came out in 2001 that was a direct response to Columbine. And that report even concluded that we actually do have the knowledge, and we've translated that knowledge into programs that are effective to prevent serious youth violence. And so it was like so many groups were all mobilized to take action. And in addition to that, the Columbine Commission, you know, their review came out, which helped lay the groundwork of a lot of things we've accomplished in the area of school safety.
Yeah, tell me about that, because, I mean, again, we've seen other school shootings, and I think everyone, it's often easy to look at what happened at Columbine, then look at something like Uvalde or Sandy Hook or others, not all of them similar, but you know, school shootings in themselves, and sort of say, well, we're back to square one, right? I mean, this shows that we've learned nothing. And yet, over time, and you pointed this out in another interview, we have at least gotten better at trying to figure out how to better protect students within the schools and better identify those who may be on the verge of committing an act of violence?
Absolutely. You know, as I said, we've got crisis response protocols. We have an organization like the I Love You Guys Foundation, which has developed standard response and standard reunification protocols that are being used in 50,000 schools and locations across the world. And, you know, we've done a lot on physical security in terms of targeted hardening kinds of approaches, but those aren't violence prevention. So right. Those may mitigate a crisis, but they're not actually focused on removing the motivation for someone to want to, you know, use a firearm for criminal reasons. And so the focus on violence prevention hasn't really taken off the way it needs to. I think it's easier to think about and wrap your head around technical solutions like locks on the door, which is a good thing to do to make sure doors can lock. You know, Frank DeAngelis talked about having that right key that he was able to open the door and get the kids safe and saved a lot of lives in that, which was a miracle because when you're in a crisis, if you've ever tried to use your key after a car accident or something like that, you lose your fine motor skills. And so the fact that he was able to do that in a situation of an active shooter was amazing.
The principal, right? Yeah, yeah.
But we've actually been able to like do a lot around locks and kind of those kinds of things. But again, that is not dealing with the underlying motivation. We need to be working on upstream prevention and intervention if we really want to see change.
Beverly Kingston is with us this half hour to talk about the 25th anniversary of the Columbine High School shooting when two students murdered 12 of their classmates and a teacher in Littleton, Colorado on April 20th, 1999. 25th anniversary coming up on Saturday. She, by the way, is the director of the Center for the Study of Prevention, the Study and Prevention of Violence at the University of Colorado Boulder. Beverly, when we look at some of the things that have not been done, I mean, obviously in Canada, the conversation's often about guns. We haven't seen much in the way of change on that front in America over the last 25 years. But you've also looked into different ways to prevent this kind of violence at that level, right? And what are some of the keys to sort of identifying who may be about to commit this? Because I know you've talked about this. There have been averted incidents as well. I mean, we don't talk about the averted ones, but they do exist.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really wonderful because we're not only now looking at, you know, research from attacks that were carried out, but we're looking at research from attacks that were planned. So they were planned, you know, there's a criteria for that, but then actually were averted. And there is an averted school violence database. Frank Straub is the lead researcher on that work, and he's continues to do wonderful research in that area. And this is why this is so important. So what happens, and this has been shown in both databases, you know, when we're looking at attackers and when we're looking at averted school violence, is that we see warning signs and concerning behaviors. And in studies by the Secret Service, we've seen that in 81% of cases with attackers, they told someone what they were going to do. And oftentimes that someone else was a peer. And in 93% of those cases, other people saw concerning behavior. They saw things that didn't sit right. And so what happens then, you know, we want to make sure that people have ways to, when they see those kinds of things, that they know how to identify it, and then they know what to do with that information. So since Columbine, in many of these other cases, we've studied some of these. We've studied, like, there was a shooting in Arapaho High School, and we studied what happened there. And there were 27 missed opportunities to intervene that we counted. Parkland, there were at least 69. In report after report, pretty much we see the same information, the same lessons to be learned. And so fortunately, we are trying to work on heeding those lessons and taking action in those areas. So let me give you a couple examples.
Right.
In Colorado, we implemented a system. It's an anonymous bystander reporting system or anonymous reporting system called Safe to Tell. And that got launched in 2004. And right now, Safe to Tell gets about 24,000 tips a year. Other states have replicated similar models. And in these situations, anyone who's concerned about a behavior can contact Safe to Tell or the system that's in their state and make a report. And that report is protected, you know, they're protected by law that it will stay anonymous. And then it's answered 24/7. And when it needs to, it can go to law enforcement, or if it's a lower level concern, it can go to a safety team. And we know that these young people, or and someone, or sometimes it's adults who are on a pathway to violence, that doesn't happen overnight. You know, there's, again, these different warning signs, things that happen along the way that lead to grievances, that lead to an escalation. And it, we want to intervene at the very earliest point possible. Averted school violence, you know, when we're intervening at that place, it's earlier than a mass attack, but it's still not the earliest point possible. And that's where we look at more upstream prevention and intervention programs, because ideally someone isn't even going to go that far down the path to violence. And, you know, what we want to be doing is connecting that individual back into pro-social life to build relationships, to build connections, to find out what's really going on that needs to be helped. Those efforts are resource intensive. They're more complex. They're really talking about, as I've, you know, shared many times, building a prevention infrastructure in our society. That infrastructure is not only going to prevent this mass targeted violence kinds of things that we're seeing, but it's going to prevent lower level issues like bullying. You know, it's going to have less fights at school. Because of all that, there'll be less trauma and lower levels of substance misuse.
Right. It
can do a lot of good overall, but it's big picture thinking. It is comprehensive. It's expensive. It's not a quick fix. It's not easy to even explain. I'm trying to do it here on
it that. Is. No, I mean, I think people understand the societal and systemic issues that are at play here. And I mean, it, obviously it's a far more complex than automatic locks on doors, right? And that's why automatic locks on doors is what we talk about. Listening to, though, it must feel like sometimes when we see reports of yet another school shooting, obviously guns are always a concern. It must sometimes feel like you're trying to put out a big fire with a leaky bucket.
Oh my God. That is so well said. Yeah, exactly. I do feel like that. That's maybe the best statement I've ever heard of what I feel. I've been at this job in violence prevention for over 25 years now that we do the math. And I just say the same thing over and over and over again. And I don't just say it. I mean, we have lots of projects that are working on it, but I do feel like the resources that are out there to do this work have really dried up. And wow. Like they were, you know, right after Columbine, you know, or after sometimes for some reason, sometimes the public or Congress, you know, Congress, it just seems like, I don't know what changes some of them, that more funding comes out in a different way, but it ebbs and flows. And these issues don't ebb and flow. They're really here all the time. And we need to be addressing them in a systematic way.
Yeah. Beverly, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, happy to be on the show.
You left your typewriter at my apartment, straight from the tortured poets department. I think some things I never.
That's the title track from the new Taylor Swift album called Tortured Poets Department, right? So Swifties around the world, including my former technical producer, Talia Miller, who's now working on Jazz Joe Hall's show at CKNW, is probably hunkered down listening to all of it. And there's a lot to listen to because it's a double album, 31 songs. Can you imagine? Her first album of new material, I think, since 2022's Midnights was released at midnight Eastern time today. So about what? 11 hours, 23 hours ago at this point. And believe it or not, it's already exceeded, or had earlier in the day, 200 million streams on Spotify. It's the first album to ever do that, according to Variety magazine. Of course, the number will be higher by the end of the day. I guess they do Eastern time as their 24 hours. Whatever it is, it's already broken the previous record, which was just set, by the way, by Beyonce's latest, Cowboy Carter, just a few weeks ago. Swift is still in the midst of her Eras tour, the first to ever break $1 billion in revenue. It picks up in Paris next month with 4 shows. So you can only imagine that such a pop culture phenomenon would find its way into all kinds of different places, including the classroom, and it has. Universities such as Harvard, Stanford, and Berkeley are already offering courses in disciplines including English, political science, and business with a Taylor Swift theme. Queen's University in Kingston actually offered a course on Swift's, quote, literary legacy in 2022. And now you can add the law to that list. Swift Justice, we want to call it. Swift Justice. What could Taylor Swift, how would you build a law course around Taylor Swift? It's a good question, right? But there's lots of stuff around copyright, her fight with Spotify, and so on. Keep in mind, when she recorded all those albums that she called Taylor's version, she was remaking albums for which she didn't have the rights to those songs anymore. They were owned by somebody else. So she remade them, she had written them, and now she has the rights to those masters, as they're called, as well. Mohammed Kimji is the Associate Dean of Academic Policy at Queen's Law School, and he's the one who's just announced a course that he'll be teaching in September called The Law, brackets, Taylor's Version, of course. So again, what can Swift's career teach us about entertainment law? Mohammed Kimji joins me now from Kingston to explain. Mohammed, thanks for your time tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
It is. I mean, this is always such a big deal because, of course, I realized that, you know, it was on the front page of the New York Times today, right? If you still read hard copies, it was on the front page of the New York Times today. But a Taylor Swift album release, given the kind of year 2024 has been and 2023 was, no surprise that the new album is getting a lot of attention. Have you listened to it?
I have listened to it once.
Right.
I have a job, unfortunately. So I've been working all day, but I plan on listening to it all weekend.
I know people who, one of our former technical producer, Talia, is a huge Swift fan. She would take days off. I think she's off today so she can listen to it.
Oh, that's awesome. I should have done that. Yeah, I should have done that. But I figured it's Friday. I can wait a day.
Right. How did you, have you been a longtime fan of the music? Was there a time you sort of clicked into it? Because I remember Shake It. I remember sort of the earlier hits, but I was sort of, you know, of a man of my age, I was somewhat oblivious to just how popular she had become and was becoming.
Oh, I can relate to, you know, a man of a certain age comment that you just made. I mean, I was completely oblivious to her until the pandemic.
Right.
So in the pandemic, she released this album called Folklore. I read a review about it. And what I found really interesting is she had collaborated with Justin Vernon of Bon Iver.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a huge fan of Bon Iver. And just reading about the album, I got the impression she was trying to make her own version of For Emma Forever Ago.
Right.
And that intrigued me. And so I listened to it and I loved it instantly. And I've been a fan ever since. But yeah, I was completely oblivious to just how much of a social phenomenon she was.
And has become. I mean, this year, the last 12 months have been almost I mean, I haven't seen a social phenomenon like this Eras tour, like the relationship with Travis Kelce. I mean, I haven't seen someone this talked about in a long time.
Oh, I mean, I would say that, you know, she dominates culture to such a degree that we would actually struggle to find a historical comparison.
Yeah.
We would struggle to find one. I mean, just to give you an extreme example today, the prime ministers of Singapore and Thailand are fighting over which country's got the exclusive right to host the Eras tour.
Yeah, she moves. Yeah, she creates diplomatic scandals. I mean, that's how big and moves economies, right? I mean, there was the Eras tour was creating sort of not only sort of literally seismic events in places like Seattle, but for the economy of the U.S., I think the Eras tour was predicted to have or was forecast to be adding a certain amount of money to each city she was in.
No, that's absolutely right. And not an insignificant amount. Like, we're talking huge amounts. And it seems accurate to me.
Interestingly enough, the law is your, you're mentioning you had to work today. The law is your job, teaching the law now. Tell me a bit about this idea of teaching a Taylor's version law course, because some might sort of dismiss it as, you know, a flavor of the day kind of thing. But if you actually dig into what it is that you're doing and how you're framing it, it's pretty fascinating stuff.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, I have had the, oh, this is a joke kind of reaction, in addition to, you know, wild enthusiasm, right? I've had those extremes. So I'll tell you how it came about. It came about spontaneously just about a month ago. I was talking to one of my colleagues, and we were, she's also a fan, and so we were just going through the re-recorded albums and debating whether the Taylor's version was better or whether the original version was better. But as part of that conversation, she just asked me, "Well, why did Taylor Swift re-record her albums? Like, why did she do that?" And so I started to explain the business reasons, the legal reasons, why an artist might want to do that. And it made me think, my students would also be interested in learning about this, right? They would be interested in learning about it. And so I started doing some research into her various legal interactions with the law. And I realized that there was enough there for me to structure a whole entertainment law course, but relying upon exclusively Taylor Swift case studies. And so that's how the idea came about, Law Taylor's Version.
Right. How is it received? As you pointed out, it might be, it sounds like a really interesting way of packaging what would otherwise be, I wouldn't say, I mean, there's nothing particularly dry. It's not like taking, contract law, for instance. There are other things within the law that sound a lot less alluring than entertainment law. But how is it received when you pitch this as a as an entertainment law course built around the idea of Taylor Swift?
Well, I think it really depends on whether you're asking a fan or not.
True enough.
I mean, I've had different reactions, and the fans, which generally is a lot of people, seem to be very enthusiastic about it. The non-fans, I mean, I think there's a bit of a dismissive attitude to bridging the gap between, an academic subject or even a professional subject such as law, and pop culture. However, if you ask me, everybody would agree, every teacher would agree that case studies are a highly effective way of engaging students, facilitating active learning, and so on. And so to me, there's no difference between a case study that draws upon a pop culture phenomenon and a case study that draws upon another kind of social phenomenon.
Right. I mean, it's all really just the wrapping, right? I mean, ultimately, the education is the same. This isn't sort of, you can't walk in with just knowing you're Taylor Swift. You're going to need to know your law to get through this course.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm not going to have an exam where people have to sing Shake It Off or anything like that.
Right. Mohammed Kimji is an Associate Dean of Academic Policy at Queen's Law School at Queen's University. In September, he's going to launch an entertainment law course that is sort of Taylor's version, Taylor Swift's version. And it's kind of built around the case studies involving Taylor Swift because she's been had some brushes. No, she hasn't had brushes with the law per se, but her career has led her to have to turn to legal solutions to some of the problems that she's run into. Mohammed, you already mentioned the most obvious one, which, of course, is if anyone out there wonders why there's this whole set of albums that she re-recorded called Taylor's Version, where the name of the course comes from, is that someone else owned all the rights to her earlier records. So she basically decided to re-record them all so that they could be hers again.
That's absolutely right. So her old record company owned the recording. The technical expression for that is the masters, right? And then those were sold off to Scoot Abroad, and so she decided to re-record her albums w so that she would get ownership over the masters of those re-recorded albums.
Right. So she still doesn't own the masters of the originals, right?
No, she doesn't. But what's astonishing about her specific example, she's not the first artist in history to re-record albums. I mean, others have tried it. They just haven't been successful at it to the extent
Yes.
she has.
Which is remarkable. So I suppose in this case, the law of this is sort of understanding copyright and understanding how an artist can go about trying to sort of go around that copyright, which is essentially what Taylor Swift did, even though they are her songs.
No, that's absolutely right. But beyond that, I mean, she has had an impact on the music industry and the negotiation of these contracts. And I'll give you a famous example of this. In 2020, Olivia Rodrigo was negotiating her deal, and as part of that negotiation, she insisted on owning the masters
Right.
and cited Taylor Swift explicitly as her inspiration for doing that.
Right. And of course, Taylor Swift often talks about the fact that, I mean, at the time that she sort of got into these first deals, which many artists find themselves in, by the way, they have very little power and they end up giving away a lot of rights to things that later they regret or wish they hadn't. And this was an example of that.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, often early on in a musician's career, they're so keen to acquire the recognition that they don't have a lot of bargaining power. But that's shifting to some degree. Artists are now more and more insisting on control over their output.
Right, which of course, so we've been through phase one, case study number one. The other one that's really interesting, because I'm sure a lot of the listeners out there will have turned to Spotify at some times in their lives and may know that certain artists have have a bone to pick with Spotify and have in the past over the way royalties are paid. And Taylor Swift was one of those artists for quite a while. You could not find her music on that streaming service.
Yes, and that's just another example of her astonishing influence in the music industry and how just on her own, she's capable of changing what the norms are.
This had to do with royalties, right? Which is another part of entertainment law, which is also an interesting one as well. Like, how are they paid out? And especially with streaming, a lot of artists have been really upset with just how little money they make off. I mean, many artists point out just how little money they get for each time their song is streamed versus what they would get if it was being played on radio, for instance.
No, that's absolutely right. And so, you know, to have your music on a platform such as Spotify, you have to enter into an agreement with Spotify. And that agreement is going to set out how the profit sharing will work.
Right. And if you're unhappy with it, well, good luck, right? You have to fight them, which she did.
Well, you have to leave. You know, right. Don't have your music on the platform. But she is so influential that Spotify would want her on their platform.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in some senses, the only, I'm not a legal scholar, obviously. The only thing about her is that she somehow, as a case study in entertainment law, there, she has that intangible other, which is a huge amount of power, right? I mean, in her own way, which is interesting because I'm not saying it twists it, but it does add, there is that element in there too, where what she does, a lot of artists wouldn't get away with legal or otherwise.
Yes. I mean, she has this devotion that you typically see with only a cult artist with a small following.
Right.
I mean, this is the first time I've ever seen a mainstream artist have such a devoted following, which is in effect the power behind her.
Yeah. And so come September, I suppose you'll be looking to see who's going to sign up. I imagine it'll be an interesting cross-section of people that'll sign up for this out of both sort of fandom and just pure curiosity.
I think that's right. I think sort of general interest in entertainment will definitely drive some of the enrollment. I think there will definitely be some fans. And then I think just in general, you know, there are always people who tend to follow the professor who's teaching the course. So I'll right. have some of those as well.
Well, that'll always be good. And it is an interesting idea. I mean, I think sometimes we think of law as being so stuffy and formal and precise that you can't do this kind of thing. But I mean, it's interesting to package all education in some way without getting out of control. But it's interesting to package really pertinent information in ways that is both educational and interesting.
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, I think if you're not going to engage students, then you've lost the battle.
Indeed. You should invite her to see if she'll come and talk to the course. You never know.
I wish I knew how to reach her. I mean, I'm actually, you know, I'm sort of really wishing that she contacts me.
Indeed. She may well. You never know. Mohammed, thank you so much. Good luck.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. This has been fun.
Get your monthly all-access pass to Sports Access, profiling elite female Canadian athletes. Join us every month for Sports Access, a Score original.
Great to have you here on this Friday night. You may recognize that voice. You'll certainly recognize the name Lisa Bowes, familiar to many sports fans across this country and beyond. She blazed a trail in Canada as one of the first women to hit highs in that newish world of all sports channels, right? Starting behind the scenes at TSN back in 1989 before moving in front of the camera as a reporter and then anchor. That helped launch a decades-long career in sports journalism, which included stops at the CBC, CTV, The Score. She covered women's hockey at the 2010 Olympics in Vancouver. The list goes on and on and on. And it was in the lead up to that last assignment, the 2010 Olympics, that Bowes came up with a really great idea, in part because of a futile search that she had done for books about girls in sport for her then infant daughter. The result was a character named Lucy who tries different sports, a way not only to present a positive role model for all, but also to try to get kids to embrace sports and to get them moving, right? We have a problem with childhood obesity in this country. Get them moving, get them interested in sports, give them positive role models, roll it all into one, and you have the Lucy series. The early stories had Lucy try luge and Lucy try short track speed skating. So you can see the Olympic inspiration early on, but it's grown since then. I think it's six books now. as Lucy tries out hockey, basketball, baseball, and soccer. They've been translated into other languages, including French and Spanish. They're big parts of school curriculum across the country. And even athletes such as Mark Giordano, who's now with the Leafs but was with the Calgary Flames at the time, Olympic loser Kimberly McRae, soccer's Mason Trafford of the Cavalry FC, and wheelchair rugby's Terry Tenove do readings to promote the series. Have a listen.
Lucy Tries Soccer.
Written by Lisa Bowes and illustrated by James Hearn.
It's Saturday morning with Lucy and friends. They're ready to play on field number 10.
In her new jersey, Lucy, pleased as can be, for their very first time, she'll play 3-on-3.
Time to warm up, shouts the coach of Team Blue. His name is Nick, and he knows what to do.
There you have it. I mean, most of those, by the way, if you watch the video, it's really well done. It's those athletes, most of them, not all, reading to their kids, right? And that's what it's all about. And of course, the success of the Lucy Tries series comes at the very same time when something that Lisa Bowes was always very passionate about, women's sports, is hitting new highs for viewership and interest, right? Think of the hugely successful first season of the Professional Women's Hockey League. We've talked about that on the show. The massive ratings for the recent NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament and much, much more. So lots of interesting things to chat about tonight. Lisa Bowes joins me from Calgary. Thanks. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Ben. Great to chat with you.
I was really interested in this Lucy Tries series because it's such a great idea. And the genesis of it, I gather, were a couple of things, but it happened at the 2010 Olympics. And I was thinking, what an interesting time to come up with such a cool idea.
Well, I thought it was pretty cool when I came up with it in 2008. Right. And little did I know that publishing works at a very different pace than broadcasting. And so I was there, and I was getting ready to cover women's hockey at the Vancouver Olympic Games. And I thought, wow, I'm in this Olympic mindset. Maybe we could create a series of books that were about different types of sport and Olympic sport and tie all that in with Vancouver and get those books out within 2 years. It did not happen that quickly. But I truly believed in the idea, Ben, and I felt that there was an opportunity to educate, first of all, families about different types of sport. And that's how we began with Lucy Tries Luge and then right. Short track speed skating.
I was going to say, those are some odd first sports to test out. Like Lucy Tries Luge has a great ring to it, but it's not the first sport you'd think of Lucy trying out.
No, it isn't. I mean, most people would say here in our Canadian climate, you might think hockey or maybe soccer, but I came out of the gate with something very different, but I felt it was my strongest story. And I was linking it to the fact that in northern climates, northern hemispheres, a lot of us are sliding in the wintertime. We're tobogganing with our family. And so I was making the connection to the fact that she was trying this sliding Olympic sport and that it was very similar to tobogganing at home on her own sleigh. And so that was really the genesis of it. And I said to you at the beginning of this interview, I thought I could make this happen in a couple of years. And needless to say, it took me 7 years before the very first Lucy Tries Luge book was published in 2015 in traditionally published with our wonderful publisher from British Columbia, yeah, Orca Book Publishers.
Interesting. You talked about Luge too. I think we had Haley Clark on the show not long ago. She's the world skeleton champ now, right? And she must have just been young when you were writing that book. But it's amazing to see, and it was amazing to listen to her talk about how she got into Luge. She was actually also in Calgary. Her mother, I think, was a strength coach for the skating team. But it's amazing to see, both from the books and just from sports in general, it's amazing to see examples of young women performing at that elite level and just how much it can change people's mindsets about what is possible.
Oh, 100%. And I mean, Lucy really is. So she is the lead character and she is that empowering figure for all children. Yes, 100% for our little girls to see that figure on the front cover. And she is a unique figure in sports literature, in sports kids literature. And so I just love to see that also coming from my background in sports media, but also our little boys love Lucy just as much because right, children really do not see gender. They see a cool kid. She's trying something and they are trying so hard in school, trying to learn their numbers and read and write. And so that's what this is all about, Ben. The mission statement is truly about inspiring are all children to be active, number one, to persevere. That's why tries is so important in the title, and to do so as they learn to read. And therefore, they can therefore lead healthier and happier lives. So it really is connected to that perseverance and getting our children to move more and to try many different sports. So Lucy really is that multi-sport champion.
Right. It's not Lucy conquers hockey or Lucy slays basketball. It's tries, right? I should have figured that out when I was looking at the titles. It's interesting, though, how this wraps in so many things that you've done over the course of your lifetime, not just your personal life as well, being a mom, but obviously your long career in sports broadcasting, and as well as your college studies too, like your university studies. It all kind of wraps into one to try to want to encourage kids to move regardless of gender and also try to give them some positive role models.
Yes. And I don't think that I ever would have thought when I began my studies at Western University many, many moons ago in kinesiology that I would be here, you know, many decades later. But it really does come back to my kin degree about feeling this passion to try to get everyone in that active mindset. So we know the research is very clear that an active start will equal an active life. And growing up with boys as I did and being active my whole life and how important sports was for me as a young girl and then later as a woman and then moving on into sports media and then becoming a mom and recognizing, wow, I really need to get my child, you know, experiencing all that sport can offer, Ben. We know so much about what it can do for us in terms of social benefits, right? My daughter has met so many new friends outside of high school because of being involved in sport, the mental benefits. We'd have to do a whole other half hour, I think, to discuss the benefits of mental health, but the physical benefits, and also we can say the spiritual benefits, even, you know, yoga. I mean, anything that I believe that there is something for everyone. And when I see in Canada, some of these physical literacy rates that continue to decline or to continue to stay stagnant, overall physical activity in Canada at a D, and children age 5 to 11, only about 30 to 35% of them are actually reaching their recommended physical activity guidelines. So 70%, 65% are not. I think we have a great deal of work to do, and that's where Lucy Tries, the book series, is trying to help solve that issue.
I was part of what you've explained was at the time your daughter was very young, you were looking for this kind of a book. And I was surprised that it didn't exist because I would have thought someone would have clued in at some point that this was a great idea. Not to take away from your great idea, but I was surprised that by, you know, 2010 and so that, or, you know, this is only 15, 16, 17 years ago, that these books weren't already out there. But they did wind up filling a void.
I think they did because that's what I love to see and get the feedback from all the educators in Canada that I've worked with virtually and in person about how they are able to use this particular type of picture book because it is really built on and reinforcing accepted principles of healthy child development. And that's what I say about the tries is so important. The teachers love that perseverance factor, but they use this in a lot of their lesson plans. And those accepted principles, Ben, are what we know our children need in order to stay in sports. So there's five of them. This is actually, I'm really helping to reinforce High Five Canada, which is five things. So what we know our kids need, they need to play. They need to participate. They need to have a voice in their play. They need to make friends. So important for girls. They need to master a skill. And the last thing, and maybe one of the most crucial ones, is having that encouraging adult relationship, that being the coach.
It's really special to have that many people here. And Toronto has really gotten behind us. Even at our other games, we've been sold out in Mattamy. And this was obviously quite a bit bigger. But yeah, it just shows the demand for women's hockey and women's sport and playing in this venue was something that we're always going to cherish for the rest of our lives.
Lisa Bowes, author now of the Lucy Tries series, a book series encouraging young kids, girls, as well as boys to get into sports, and obviously the longtime sports broadcaster. Lisa, it's been really interesting because, of course, my mom was a broadcaster, and very early on, probably in the early 80s, she said to me, I'd love to be, you know, I should go into sports. The problem was she wasn't a big sports fan, right? So it kind of stopped and started there, and she wound up doing many other fantastic things. but you really blazed a trail amongst others in the late 80s into the 90s. And I was curious to know what you think of the landscape today, because it feels like every year something new happens, either on the broadcasting side or just on the athletic side, that is a reminder that there's a huge appetite out there for women's sports, like the Women's World Cup in soccer, or the European Cup in soccer. We've seen the women's soccer team, obviously the Canadian team, do really well. We've had the PWHL now, the NCAA women's basketball tournament, perhaps the latest example. It feels like we've really turned a corner this way, and I was wondering what you thought about it.
I think it's a long time coming, Ben. And I think it's just tremendous for young boys and young girls to see this kind of sport in front of them. And most importantly, being covered on, for example, Sports Center or Sports Central, right? To actually have them as part of the highlight packages. I think that is a really important factor. And the fact that they're putting also a lot of these games on in prime time also speaks to the fact that there is an appetite. I don't think that appetite was ever there many years ago. I mean, I actually had a wonderful opportunity to do some play-by-play of the original National Women's Hockey right. League. And that was 24 years ago now. And then I did some U Sports basketball and some U Sports hockey, but those were very hit and miss. I mean, maybe three a year. And so to see now though where and all the work that's been done for the PWHL, Jaina Hefford and her team to get that up and going. And I think a lot of that had to do with the other league in the United States disbanding and them forming one strong league. That was a major factor. And also affiliating themselves, too, with the men's leagues. That's also a big factor. Caitlin Clark, I mean, what an astounding story. And I think what you're finding is that a lot of broadcasters and now the networks, and then you get them on side. Next thing you know, you have sponsors, and now we're ready to really cook with, you know, we've really got some gas on the fire, because you need the sponsors to get the TV, and TV needs the sponsors to get it on the air. So when everybody realizes that there's incredible content, incredible stories, even when I was at the Score, we had a show called Sports Access that was about female elite athletes, but we just told it like it was stories, and obviously they were female. That is 24 years ago. So as I say to you, a long time coming, and I'm so happy to see it. And finally, so happy to see the opportunities for the broadcasters.
Yeah, that's been a big change. That's been a big change.
In my day, yes, indeed. In my day, there would not have been that many opportunities because there weren't that many games or leagues on the air. I mean, the WNBA was really the only thing that was out there in terms of women's sport on a consistent basis.
What would you like to see grow out of this? Because I don't feel like it's a phase. I think you point out, and I don't mean to badmouth the business around this, but they're not doing this out of the goodness of their hearts. They're doing this because they see a business opportunity in women's sport, I think. They see that people will watch it and enjoy it and consume it. And there's just another, I mean, that's what it's all about. But what would you like to see happen next, do you think? Where do you think this goes? And how do you build on it?
Well, I think what would be really fantastic is if I always have this thing about, and maybe it's from my background, where people would, back in the day, they might refer to me as a female sportscaster.
Right.
And that always really irked me, right? Because I really got into this business to try to be a good all-round sportscaster. And to myself, I felt I look visually, I am female. This is how I felt about it. And I don't think you would say, well, he's a really tremendous male sportscaster,
right? Of course, the qualifier. Yes, you're right. At the time, I suppose there was a novelty, but it was. I can see. I obviously see how you would react to it that way.
Yeah, and so I would love it if we kind of could get away from some of those qualifiers when we're still now, as this is becoming more and more of a thing, if you will. I would love to see. Sometimes I still see on websites that the instead of having NHL, NBA, there might be women's sports.
Yes.
I think we need to get rid of that and just treat it as a sport, because that's what it is, and just treat it as such. Words matter. And also, I know that there was something that was just on Instagram about Caitlin Clark and
yes, I saw that.
it's hard to imagine
2024, but here we are.
Here we are. And so I think that still has a little bit more way to go, especially in women's tennis, when I see how, or to my point, I should be saying
tennis.
WTA.
We're conditioned. It's tough. You're right. Yeah. But I just say tennis. What do you think? Right. I mean, maybe tennis is a bit more, has been a bit more egalitarian over the years in terms of fandom. But yeah, if you just said, I'm watching the hockey game, what's the first thing that pops to mind? It should be both the NHL or the PWHL.
Yeah. I mean, it's clearly, to me, it's just, this is the women playing. Okay. Yeah. Right. But we don't need to use that in our coverage all the time. And I think that they're, you're talking to somebody, though, that I went through an era where we weren't even allowed in the dressing rooms.
Right.
And people will say to me, often they would say, oh, but we wouldn't be allowed into the women's room, like meaning so a women's pro team. Like, and I would say, oh, no, they want that. Those athletes would want that, because then that means that it's an equal. If you're going into the male dressing room, then let's go into the female dressing room. And those players, I know they wanted that, because that would mean there's our equality. There's the equity. Right. So I think I'm a long way in this regard, Ben. But I do believe, too, some of our language and how we treat these athletes, how we cover these sports, we still have a little bit of room to grow.
The next frontier. Lisa, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.